This episode of Section D was first broadcast on Tuesday the 10th of July on Monocle 24. Section D is brought to you in association with Lexis. Hello and welcome to Section D, the weekly design hour here on Monocle 24 with me, Hugo MacDonald. Ahead over the next hour, we ask whether architects and urban planners can help make people fit. New York Commissioner for Design, David Burney, says yes.
Urban design architects, planners can do a number of things to increase people's access and encourage mobility in the way they design.
Mirko Zardini, director of the Canadian Centre for Architecture, says no.
I think that architecture is not the problem solving, it's part of the problem.
We drop in on two ambassador residences in Wellington to see how they make home sweet home so far from home.
The thing with an official residence is that it is both a platform for your country and you use it for official purposes. But when you're not doing those functions, it is equally your home.
And of course, we couldn't do a show without mentioning the Olympics. This time, we're heading to the Russian embassy in London to find out about their exhibition of 20th century Russian sports posters.
Most of the posters have never been seen outside Russia before, and many are rare surviving examples commissioned from some of the best known artists of the day.
That's all to come in the next hour on Section D, here on Monocle 24. For our weekly design dispatch, we're off to the Portuguese capital this week, Lisbon. From its 18th century avenues with their rusty, rich patinas, to its youthful experimental architecture and entrepreneurial scene, Lisbon is as contradictory as it is charming. But is it possible for Europe's oldest capital to be a home for young designers and architects, especially in times of financial crisis? Saima Tariq talks to the people who believe, by returning to its manufacturing and architectural heritage, that it can.
I mean, how do I see design, today in Lisbon?
Frederico Duarte is a design critic and graphic and product design tutor. He's talking to me as we enjoy the sunshine in the commercial Chiado neighbourhood.
I guess it's because of the economical context. It can be a turning point. One of the things that's been not necessarily discussed in my view, but hinted here and there sometimes, is are we seeing a return to manufacturing in Portugal? And of course, the results of that manufacturing being sold or displayed or talked about in Lisbon.
It could be argued that Portuguese industry was suffering before the economic crisis. Many factories, from textiles and furniture to shoe and glassmaking, had been producing for outside firms and exporting all over the world, until much cheaper manufacturing nations undercut their prices, not to mention the influx of superbrands such as IKEA. The challenge now, Frederico says, is for Portugal to refocus on its expertise and on its own market.
We're kind of faced with this challenge. Either you make very high-end luxurious products, and you have, for example, people like a Boca do Lobo, you'll be making a Russian oligarch bling-bling furniture. Or you have, for example, a lot of designers and a few designers who are investing in making their own things and kind of controlling the manufacturing processes or working with craftsmen and working on close-knit manufacturing relations. Examples of designers, younger and older, some of them are students, who are getting together and actually starting to do that. And one of the interesting things is now this entrepreneurial burst in the country. There's all these startup competitions. The reason for that, in the end, may be, can we create a different market for Portuguese design? It could be furniture, it can be ceramics, it can be glass, it can be even clothing. A few experiments in the late 90s and early 2000s, like M Glass, which was kind of this umbrella brand for Portuguese glass, which didn't work because it was a top-down strategy, because you're putting competitors working under a common label, and you're hiring foreign designers and trend companies, and that really didn't work. What I like to see in the 5 to 10 next years would be that retailer or manufacturer that addresses the middle market. So it's people who want better than IKEA but can afford luxury products. One of the stores that's kind of doing that is Aria. They developed their own brand products, mainly textiles, but also a bit of furniture products. And I think they're doing an interesting job, not only working on what is Portuguese design, but kind of working as a lifestyle option, you know, like Movi Flor, which is an historical, kind of crummy and not great manufacturer and retailer of furniture and other household goods, could work on their brand, they can work on their designs, they can work on their manufacturing. They should be the ones who employ young designers and even trend specialists and even fashion designers and kind of address what people want to buy. This is a time that people will want to buy Portuguese. We want to buy and export and we want to contribute to our country's economy.
One store that is harnessing the trend for made in Portugal is A Vida Portuguesa. Founded by local entrepreneur Catarina Portas, it sells beautifully made and packaged objects, from Porto-made soaps to locally designed notebooks. Much of its quality stock are from brands that have been around for more than a century, giving the retro aesthetic a deeper meaning.
I think one that Vida Portuguesa does that very beautifully is that it creates a sense of, hey, I like to belong to this, you know, I like to be part of this. It really speaks to, it very intelligently speaks to people's memories, but also, for example, I wasn't born when, you know, the quote toothpaste was around, and I actually don't like it that much. But I understand why people like it and swear by it. And I think that's something that's probably the logical next step, because if you realize a lot of those products haven't been really changed over the years, is can we make a kind of store that deals with products made now?
Architects have also been forced to think about their city's future, particularly Inês Lobo, who has been invited by David Chipperfield to curate an exhibition about Lisbon's urban potential at this summer's Venice Biennale.
It's a moment that we can realize that we have lots of good architects working in the center of Lisbon. It's incredible. That never happens in this city. Never. Never happens. It's not true. It happens, but a long, long time ago, you know. I think this exhibition is going to give the opportunity to make this clear, very clear for them, because I don't know if they have that conscience also, the architects, for them and for all the people that can see the exhibition and for the people that live here and for the people that are thinking about Lisbon. It's incredible the quantity of projects that are talking about the same thing.
The exhibition titled Lisbon Ground features a top lineup, including Pritzker Prize winner Eduardo Souto de Moura and Alvaro Siza, who will receive a Lifetime Achievement Award at the event. The team will display and discuss past projects and future solutions to a city built on 7 ancient hills overlooking the Tagus estuary.
We have a difficult relation with the river, but a very beautiful one, I think. We have a city where we are always looking, facing the river. When we don't expect, we climb a street and in the end we look and there is the river. But when we want to arrive near the river, it's difficult because we have a port, and the port is a very important piece for the city, for our economy. The river must be a machine, must be a place to circulate, to work, and so on. And we have a very, very beautiful project done between before 1930, 1960. It's for the port. It's incredible because it's a project with the several kilometers all along the coast with lots of beautiful details. It's incredible because if you walk along the river, you see a work made with the stone. Everything is designed and everything is repeated all along the coast. The idea is not to have a big sidewalk along the river, very romantic. I think that's not the theme for Lisbon. The idea is to have points where you can go and be in the river. At specific points, to explain this, I choose three projects. One is the terminal, the cruise terminal, made by João Luís Carrilho da Graça. It's an important operation for the port, but for the city also. And it's very well done. Then another one that I like very much is Ribeira das Naus, made by João Gomes da Silva and João Nunes. And I like it because it's if you were going back in history. They are discovering again the ancient spaces of Ribeira das Naus and give it to the city again, but as a public space.
Another crucial talking point is the downtown neighbourhood, Baixa. Many of its grand Pombalina buildings, built in triumph after the 1755 earthquake, now lay empty, despite focused reconstruction in nearby Chiado after a devastating fire in the 80s. Alvaro Cesar set the bar for rebuilding those central streets, and Inés believes in learning from him.
For Lisbon downtown, we have the project of Cesar, that it's, for me, the beginning of this history that I want to to talk in Venice. Chiado was done 24 years ago. It's a lot. And I think it was the beginning of something. When Cesar said that we cannot build new here because Chiado, it's a big building, it's a big corp, and we cannot take from that corp an arm or a leg or part of the head. We must rebuild everything as it was. It was really a statement, I think. I think for Lisbon this is a good moment because I don't think we need to build more. Now we cannot build anymore because we don't have money, and we are obliged to stop, think, and then go on. During the past years, we built a lot. New neighborhoods, more buildings, more houses. Did we need it? I don't think so. We have houses for everybody. We have lots of houses that are not occupied. So we have to think a little bit about something that is not functioning very well in the city, that is the question of proximity. To find a way to live well in a neighborhood. It's a beautiful system, but that it is working in a very stupid way. If you want, you don't use the public space as you could use it. So you can do really small things, reinvent a little bit the way how to occupy what you have, and have a better life in the city.
Though these are uncertain times for designers and architects in the Portuguese capital, now seems to be a defining moment, particularly as they learn from the past to work towards their city's future. For Monocle in Lisbon, I'm Saima Tarek.
Things sound positive for the creative community in the bustling streets of the Portuguese capital. Next week, we'll be putting the Argentine capital of Buenos Aires through its paces. In the meantime, though, we're heading over to the Big Apple after this short break.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
Premiering on Monocle.com, a film about the city we feel ranks number one for quality of life. Monocle's annual survey goes beyond the basic economic and social aspects of a city, identifying often overlooked factors that can bring happiness and ease to everyday life. And for the second time running, climbing back up to the number one spot, it's Zurich.
On a sunny early summer's day in Zurich, a handful of its residents have made their way to Badi Enge, one of several bathing houses situated along the waterfront, offering decks for sunbathing, bars, and even saunas. The scene is especially notable for taking place minutes from downtown, and it's what sets Zurich immediately apart. This is a city with abundant and interconnected green space, cut through by rivers leading to its lake, all of it set up to be enjoyed by the population.
You can watch this film, plus our top 25 most livable city countdown, on monocle.com.
Welcome back to Section D. Now, there's a growing debate in some of the world's larger metropolises that the way cities are built directly correlates with the health of their inhabitants. That's not to say that we can blame architects for rising obesity rates, but more that health and well-being should be a higher concern for architects and urbanists when it comes to planning and development. One of the more vocal proponents is David Burney, New York's Commissioner for Design and Construction. And one of the more vocal opponents is Mirko Zardini, director of the Canadian Centre for Architecture. Monocle's Barrett Austin sat down with Bernie in New York to find out more. And to hear the other side, so to speak, I spoke to Zardini in the studio here in London after that. But first up, here's New York.
I think obesity is a coin with two sides. On the one side, you do have nutrition, and people do not eat sufficiently healthy food and eat a lot of unhealthy food, and I think that has gotten worse over time. But on the other side, we're also living an increasingly sedentary lifestyle, and our built environment contributes quite a lot to that in terms of the amount of driving that we do, the introduction of the elevator, the fact that there are so many ways to do things without ever moving or expending much energy, and that has been a contributor to the problem.
And how can you, as a designer with the city, what sort of role can you play in terms of turning things around?
Urban design architects, planners can do a number of things to increase people's access and encourage mobility in the way they design. And we think about it at several levels of scale. If you think about the building scale, for example, you'll walk into an office building, you will see a bank of elevators, you will have trouble even finding the staircase if you wanted to use it. People who work in a multi-story building want to go from one floor to another, they go to the elevator bank. It's actually much more efficient to provide connecting staircases. And that's the kind of thing that we're trying to reintroduce, because it will allow people mobility, it will reduce the energy consumption used by elevators.
One of the things that you've spoken about in your presentation is the idea of the program for active guidelines?
The active design guidelines.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about the active design guidelines.
The active design guidelines grew out of a realization that when we had a series of conferences talking about how to make the built environment more conducive to exercise and mobility, we realized there was a lot of academic research out there to do with the connection between stair use and obesity, reducing obesity, and that there were a whole series of best practices that, if you collected them all together, would become a kind of very useful guidebook for architects and designers and planners. So that's how the idea came out about publishing the active design guidelines.
One of the sort of common themes that comes about in cities, particularly in a place like New York, is you find that some of the poorest of areas are often the ones with the greatest incidences of obesity. Why is this, and what is the city doing to target this?
That's a difficult question. You're absolutely right. The epidemiologists will tell you that there's a very high correlation between obesity, diabetes, and the health-related issues of obesity and areas of poverty. One of the presentations we saw at the EPO today was that the highest correlating indicator is property values. The lower the property value, the more likely there are to be obese inhabitants. How you sort of unpackage that and understand it is a subject for the epidemiologists, but we do know that there are certain constants. For example, people in high areas of obesity often have limited access to recreational open space. They often will have limited access to public transit. They will often have limited access to healthy food. So all of those factors, we think that we can do something in the built environment to address.
What are some of the broad ideas that city planners can put into place to increase health outcomes amongst city dwellers?
I think a number of things. Access to recreational open space obviously is very important. The increasing number of parks that the mayor of New York City has been introducing is very important. Childhood obesity is a huge problem. There's been a big focus on sports and recreation for children and access to healthier food. Transportation-based planning is a huge factor as well, because it's been demonstrated that if people take public transportation rather than drive, even if they're riding a bus or a subway, they're walking from their residence to the point of public transportation, from their destination to their place of work, they're walking again. So these things definitely contribute to reducing obesity.
And what about the rise of the bicycle? Obviously, it's been around for ages, but it's something we're really putting more of a focus on. Here in New York, in a couple of weeks, we're going to see the unveiling of the city bike program, you know, comparable to what you find in other great cities around the world. How big of an impact do you think bicycling can have for the health of citizens here in New York City?
I think it has a huge impact, and it already has over the last few years when the Department of Transportation under Jeanette Sadik-Cohen began introducing the bicycling program. It's another example of build it and they will come. Once the streets were made more favorable to cycling and the bike lanes were introduced, people are out there biking, and there's no question that there's a strong correlation between cycling and health. It improves air quality, it reduces auto accidents and fatalities, so there are multiple benefits.
And to sort of readdress some of the things that we just discussed a moment ago, what are some of the design elements that are falling into place that are really helping to encourage citizens to become more and more active?
I think in terms of urban design, I think the walkability of the city has been a huge factor. If you think about the plaza program now, there's, I think, about 100 plazas in various stages of development in the city. And what we've found is that even when the Department of Transportation creates a temporary plaza just with a few bollards and some chairs, they immediately fill with people. People are walking the city much more. I think that's been a tremendous factor. Added to that, the cycling. And then I think on the transportation side, the idea of encouraging better public transit, the investment in the subway system, the bus rapid transit systems now that are coming into play have been another factor. And on the building side, I think the idea that the staircase should be brought back and people who are able should use the staircase has a huge impact also. I think most of the medical professionals and the epidemiologists will tell you that you don't need to do a whole lot of exercise to stay healthy, particularly among the senior population. If people will walk just a few minutes a day on a regular basis, the impact on health and longevity is quite significant.
I'm joined now by Mirko Zaldini, who is the director of the CCA. Mirko, thank you very much for coming into the studio. We've just heard from David Burney in New York, who is a great advocate of fit cities. What's your take on this?
Well, in a certain way, I like what they are doing. My concern is not about that. My concern is about the expectation and the agenda behind what they are doing. I have nothing against making public space more fit to the people or to have stairs in the building. What I'm very worried about is to have the expectation that this will be really the solution to bring the solution to certain problems. I am against the idea of architecture as a therapeutic machine, and I think the architecture is less than that, is not pretending to cure anybody, but at the same time is also more than that. So in a certain way, it has to take care, and to take care in a much more larger, broader sense than from a pure medical perspective.
So you have at the Canadian Centre of Architecture an exhibition called Imperfect Health.
Yeah.
The demedicalization of architecture. And is that really what you're saying here, is that there's too much emphasis or too much responsibility placed on architects at the moment to be problem solvers when it comes to health?
Yeah, I think that architecture is not a problem solving, is part of the problem. So to think that you are coming to a situation and you're offering a solution is always a very dangerous way to look at the role of a project of architecture. I feel that you have to recognize that you are part of a conflict, of a situation. And the exhibition that we did was very difficult because the point was not the idea to have really a solution to the problem, but representing how this kind of problem, which is now so important in our society, is in reality provoking very different contradictory answer in the architectural practice. So it was mainly a recognition of the complexity of the problem.
I mean, buildings, you can't help but agree that buildings do affect the way that we feel.
Yeah.
And I mean, what is the extent to which architects should think of health when they are building, or maybe city planners? I mean, David Burney feels very strongly that cities can be built in a way that does improve people's health. That seems like common sense in this day and age. So is it just that maybe people put too much responsibility on the architect and the city planner to solve problems that it's not their domain.
No, I think that it's true that you shape the environment and the environment as an effect. But what is my concern is that the only debate going on in architecture today, or one of the many debates, is about medical issues, which means that you look at the reality always through a medical lens, a medical perspective. And I was thinking that 20, 30, 40 years ago, most of the problem, like, for example, inequality, was not addressed through the medical perspective, but in a much larger sense. So that is my concern. Architecture is incorporating the issues of obesity. Already, you know, you incorporate a certain set of values. If you are obese, already there is a moral judgment about you, that you didn't take responsibility, you have perhaps not eaten in a proper way, you are not practicing active life. So as soon as you say, well, architecture has to keep you active and you put the stairs in this proper way and we hide the elevator, which is nice because I am nothing against that. But in a certain way, what you are saying, you are really already accepting this kind of set of judgment on the problem without any further reaction. And because health today is mainly considered after the, how can I say, the disappearance of the welfare state, a personal responsibility and not anymore a social responsibility, I feel that architecture today, in incorporating a lot of these kind of issues and values, is in a certain way reproducing this idea that health is a personal responsibility only and no more a social responsibility. And as you know, I am in favor of the welfare state. In spite of the problem that we had in the past.
Do you think that people might start blaming architects for their obesity?
We are living a very interesting moment in which I think that most of the values are changing in our society. And this has to happen also in architecture. So I feel that for me, the most important things that I'll be interested in, if architecture, instead of, again, being prisoner of this iconic bubble, will start to look at the environment in respect to the users. So to value more not only the visual aspect, but also the experience that you can have.
That was Mirko Zardini, director of the Canadian Centre for Architecture, with me in Studio 2 earlier. And staying on the topic of health, here's Fitness Forever, a wonderful Italian group, with Probablemente. That was Fitness Forever with Probablemente. You're listening to Section D here on Monocle 24. Loyal listeners of the show will remember we spoke in episode 27 back in April to Jord den Hollander about his film Mission Statements on the architecture of Dutch embassies around the world. But as we find out next, diplomatic architecture and design doesn't stop at the iron gate of the embassy buildings. Our Auckland correspondent, Federico Monsalve, stepped into the cosy official residences of Britain and France in Wellington to talk about design and objects housed in diplomatic homes away from home.
I start this quest into understanding the symbiosis between a temporary house and its tribe of nomadic tenants by visiting the official residence of the British High Commissioner in Wellington. Homewood residence has sprawling gardens, three ferneries, a swimming pool, tennis and croquet lawns with a quaint summer house.
Thank you very much.
And as I'm welcomed by Hemish, their head butler, by a social secretary and a press officer, it quickly becomes apparent that making something so official into a cozy place to call your own must really take a few tricks of the trade. British High Commissioner Vicky Trudell welcomed me into her residence to discuss some of the secrets of diplomatic homes.
It is one of the heritage buildings here in Wellington. It is of a particular period, and it lends itself to that sort of English country house look. So a lot of the furniture, upholstery, the way the house is decorated and maintained plays to that, and I hope reflects that, the best of British design and style.
In the other places that you have lived, other residences that you have lived, are there any elements of design that carry through most of those residences, or are they all quite independent and quite unique in their own style and taste?
You sit down for a formal dinner, you will recognise the plates, you will recognise the style of fork and spoon, you will recognise the wine glasses that you use. Because we naturally think about our procurement as a global proposition. We are in something like 160 countries. And when you add in alongside ambassadors and high commissioners, consul generals, and where I was last at in India, deputy high commissioners as well, in some of our subordinate posts, it makes sense that we do bulk purchase.
Hamish, would you like to lead the way?
Cambria Crystal have their contract to supply all diplomatic residences around the world. And Mint in China, which is reserved for the head of missions around the world. We have our silverware, which is all stamped with the E2R crest and a small crown, all put away. And we also have a crest of George the VI.
When I host functions here, it needs to speak both of Britain, but I think also for me as the representative of my country here, I like people to have a little bit of a sense of who I am and where I come from too.
What do you carry with you to make you feel at home? Or what do you take with you that makes you connected to sort of your background, your past, your history, the place where you come from? What objects?
I carry quite a lot of objects, including some from my family, things that I inherited from my parents. So a lot of the Chinese things that you see were my mother's or came from my mother's side of the family. Now this room with its rich yellows and golds lends itself extremely well to the sort of Chinese ornaments and the embroideries in particular. You know, my blue and white porcelain and chinaware fit very well. In fact, that vase, which is an official one, wasn't there originally. I found it in one of the other rooms and I thought that's the perfect vase to put on that table because it fits with my blue and white glazed collection. You know, you can't put anything on display that would be controversial because that would not be conducive to building the right relationships. The thing with an official residence is that it is both a platform for your country and you use it for official purposes, whether for meetings or entertainment, to serve a purpose. But when you're not doing those functions, it is equally your home. This is a large house, which can feel empty when, you know, you're on your own or, you know, I'm just here with my husband. But there are parts of the house which are more private, which are more homely, which are little sanctuaries that you go to.
That need to carry objects of emotional value and also the need to find little areas of refuge within an official residence are also notions that Francis Etienne, ambassador from France in Wellington, and his wife Jane seem to echo.
Hello.
When you're ambassador in this kind of residence, normally the house is fully equipped. But upstairs is full of photos of the children, souvenirs from past postings, you know, books. My husband's an antique book collector.
So this is an example of the kind of books I love. It's called Inventaire général de l'histoire de France. It's dated from 1620. And it's actually speaking about one of the most troubled part of our history, time of the War of Religions. When you're representing your country abroad, it's always important to remind ourselves that we were sometimes, because of our own problems, in a terrible situation. And it's as well a source of quotes and ideas and sentences. It's easy because it can almost fit in a pocket. It has a skin, which is a sheepskin, and the paper has been touched by people over 400 years, almost 400 years. So you have an object which has been in the hands of 20 generations, is going into yours, and there is, in my view, a kind of responsibility of this. To use a word I truly respect, this is part of my whakapapa.
Objects that you display here in a place that's for public consumption, per se, are objects that have to represent both who you are and what your personalities are, but at the same time, your country's personality, because you're representatives of that country. How do you balance that act?
That's a very good question. I think there is an evolution with time. When we start, we feel a place, we have to absorb elements, we have to understand what you would call here the manner, that the manner in the house, that the manner in the city, that the manner in the objects as well. And then, I suppose gradually, you put more of yourself. So months after months, you tend to move certain pictures and put yours instead. Move the order of the furniture and sometimes replace the furniture. Once you understand the country, you have to do things in connection with the people around.
I suppose you do have to build up a kind of trust with the community. And I think the Kiwi community now would trust us to take away the carpets and polish the floorboards, renovate, refurbish, make it more modern.
And I suppose a house, it's like human beings. A house is alive when the move is on inside, when there is a dynamic. You never keep a house just unchanged. It's impossible. It would simply decay. So we have to think into refurbishment and into new uses of the rooms, for instance. Because the other thing which has to be said is that once you're in the place, of course you absorb the elements of the place, and there are elements that we will keep from New Zealand. But diplomats are nomads, and nomads can't travel with too many luggages.
And from Wellington, we swing across the Pacific to Brazil, to Sao Paulo, and back to London. But first, a short break.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
Graphic designer Anthony Burrell, famed for his slogan-based posters, went to Brazil earlier this year to collaborate with Sao Paulo workshop group Mesa and Cadeira. The fruits of their combined labour are coming to London now in a new exhibition at Chemistry Gallery until the 28th of July. The project is called How to Say the Most with the Least, and it's a collection of phrases that best defines the Brazilian spirit and life philosophy. Earlier this week, our Brazilian researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, spoke with Anthony and Francesca Wade and Barbara Soalheiro from Mesa and Cadeira to find out how it's possible to say the most with the least and what they said.
First, I would like to start with you, Anthony. Where did the idea came from?
Well, I was originally invited to go to Sao Paulo by Barbara and Francesca. I just got an email one morning that said, would you like to come to Sao Paulo for a week and lead a workshop? So I think it took me about 30 seconds to reply, saying, yes, please, I'd like to come. When we got there, we were working with a group of 12 people, a mixture of designers, journalists and writers. And the workshop kind of led itself, really. The way I kind of work with people, I kind of let them do their thing, really.
And as a Brazilian myself, I'm curious, what was your experience with Brazil and Brazilians?
I think from the moment I got there and all the bit in between until when I left, I think I was having the best time I've ever had.
And how did you get in touch with Francesca and Barbara, which are based in Brazil?
The original link was with Francesca. She was a student at Brighton a few years ago when I did a talk there. Obviously made a big impression on her, so...
I think it's worth saying that when Francesca, like, she made this list, she's a designer, and she made a list of, like, designers she likes. And the thing that really stuck for us with Anthony is this thing of saying the most with the least, which we think it's really relevant to the world we are living in. And this is what we try to do at Mese Cadere, to not only have someone who's completely brilliant at what they do, but also the work they do is relevant to the world we're living in. And I think this is Anthony's speciality, really. He's mastered that.
And Barbara, I know you're Brazilian, and maybe you can tell us, is there a major difference between the graphic design scene in London and in São Paulo, for example? Or yeah. Are they quite similar?
Yeah, funny enough, I think maybe Francesca, who's lived in Brazil for a while now, might even be better to answer that. But I think there's a huge difference. I think London is way more into design. I think the design scene in Brazil, you know, as a country that has to do a little bit of everything, we don't really have such a speciality, like such a specialized design scene. I think it's very different. So much that at the table with Anthony, we had journalists and writers as well as graphic designers.
I think the difference, yeah, in Sao Paulo or in Brazil is that everybody does a little bit of everything. You don't have one person that's specialized in one thing in particular. It's one thing we found when we started the workshop was that everybody just gets on with everything in Brazil. Everybody wants to work together and they want to do everything together. And I remember us commenting on that during, we're not sure if you get that in England.
And I mean, I want to talk about, a little bit about the workshop with Anthony, but first I want to understand more what is Mese in Cadeira, if you can both kind of explain to me a little bit more about the project.
I'll tell you. Well, we actually believe the only way to learn something is through doing this thing. So what we organize are working tables. We call them working tables. That's why we're called Mese Cadeira, that's table and chair. So it's a workshop, but it's completely focused on the project we have to deliver at the end of it. And when we invite a leader like Anthony, we say, we don't want you to be a teacher here. We want you to be the graphic designer that you are. So the methodology is really simple. It's, you know, get it done. You have an exhibition to get done in 6 days, get it done. We think the education will move more and more towards this learning by doing things and real life projects.
And I want to know more a little bit about this specific workshop.
So we started off, Anthony gave a brief introduction of his work and we got to know everybody at the table. The first day is always pretty much about getting to know you and the team. And then what we actually did was we discussed what the brief could be with the participants on the first evening. And when they all came in on the second evening, we had sat down and written a brief that was based on sort of the chat that we'd had the day before. And from there, we had a few days brainstorming and going through all the different messages for the exhibition. I think on the fourth day, we designed everything.
I think it was, the whole thing felt very organic. So it's like, when I arrived, I kind of had a vague idea of the kind of things we could do, but I think it was all mainly through conversation.
And now you're all bringing this project to London, right? At the chemistry gallery?
Yeah, yeah.
How did this work out?
I mean, I've had previous exhibition at chemistry, so I kind of knew the people there. And Graham, one of the people who runs it, his wife is Brazilian. So I think he was quite interested in the project. So I told him what I was doing, going to do the workshop. And then we said, well, it'd be really nice to bring all the work over to London so that everybody could kind of see, you know, what we did over there. And it kind of developed from the workshop that we got the kind of the basics of the idea of the exhibition. When you go into the exhibition in the gallery, it's a very simple space. It's a kind of classic gallery, white cube space. So there's a series of, I think there's 14 large wooden panels that line the gallery wall. 12 of them have got very large text pieces on. So these are the 12 phrases that we came up with as part of the workshop. And then the other panels have got photographs that I took in Sao Paulo and then during the workshop. And then there's a set of 12 screen-printed posters from the phrases that we made.
Well, it's a bit of a cheeky question, because the project, I know, is all about a collection of phrases. Can you tell me, like, which phrase, I mean, it's on your mind right now, maybe?
I think the one that we all liked was belong to where you are. It kind of felt relevant for a lot of people because, you know, people in the workshop, you know, were from lots of different places in Brazil. There were a couple, someone from Peru, I think, and Francesca and I from England. So, you know, this idea of a very, very kind of fluid movement of people across the world, you know, everyone interacts with everyone everywhere else now. So it's, and I think it's just that idea of finding yourself somewhere completely different, but still feeling like you can belong and, you know, find like-minded people, really.
And making the most of every situation, belonging exactly to...
Yeah, definitely.
What about you, Francesca and Barbara? Do you have any phrases that are on your mind?
Oh, well, I think belong to where you are is
it's
really
our favourite, isn't
but,
it?
Yeah. But I like them. I think together they are a really interesting way of... a really interesting insight into Brazilian mind right now. It's quite... Anthony's work is really optimistic, and Brazil is a country that is looking into the future with really optimistic, bright eyes. And I think when you look at the phrases, you totally see that. You know, you see it's a group, a creative community looking into the future with bright and optimistic eyes.
That was our reporter, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, with Anthony Burrell, Francesca Wade and Barbara Soeliero. And their joint exhibition of graphic posters, How to Say the Most with the Least, is on at London's Chemistry Gallery until July the 28th. Do pop along if you can. And before we leave you, there's time for the first of a regular series starting on Section D. As part of the Olympics, embassies and cultural institutes all over London are showcasing different exhibitions around design and architecture. First up, let's see what the Russians have in store. Monocle's Max Mukin went along to meet Anton Chesnikov.
As part of London's architecture and design section of Cultural Olympics Festival, here we have an exhibition of vintage Russian sporting posters boasting exemplary outdoor activities represented by Soviet youth. All the examples are really unique and they come from the early 20th century, 1920s and 1930s, and the post-Second World War period. Most of the posters have never been seen outside Russia before, and many are rare surviving examples commissioned from some of the best-known artists of the day. One poster issued by Tourism and Excursion Department of the All Union Central Committee of Trade Unions showed a bearded outdoor type holding a map of Moscow and surrounding countryside, urging his eager young companions to get active, saying, "On your day off, go out walking." One of the greatest works, one of the most remarkable posters, looks more like a film poster. And it's saying, "Work, build, and don't moan," instead of the film title. Most of the posters range from 1920s and 1950s, after Second World War. We have some amazing works from as early as 1892. The biggest names are the Alexander Dainecker, Viktor Koretsky, Leonid Golovanov, and Alexander Kokorekin, which continued to work and promote achievements of the physical active lifestyle of Soviet Union and Russia. These posters represent best examples of socialism art of Soviet Union. Alexander Dainecker was one of the most talented, one of the first of the Soviet artists who worked on the depiction of sporting themes in paintings, drawings, as well as posters. The artist created a whole series of depictions of sportsmen and sportswomen leaping from the ground. The posters originally intended to be displayed in factories, government offices and public spaces, were seen as one of the most important propaganda tools in promoting sport, and the exhibition includes examples from up to 1980s Moscow Olympic Games, which were very important for USSR and Russia. So during the Soviet times, these posters were used to advertise sports festivals and competitions. And right now, I think it's of paramount importance that we advertise and promote healthy lifestyle through these posters. So the sports posters were used to advertise sport festival and competitions. And right now, we think it's a great time, just right before the London Olympic Games, as well as Sochi 2014.
That was Anton Chesnikov, deputy head of the Russian Federal Agency for International Humanitarian Cooperation. And that brings us to the end of this week's Section D. Next week, we'll be finding out how a young country, Singapore to be precise, is carving out its own identity in the world of graphic design. We'll also hear how German outdoor furniture manufacturer Dedon is building lives and chairs in the Philippines. And we'll have a report from this year's design parade at the Villa Noel in Hyères, France. Today's show was produced by Alexander Mills and Gillian Tobias. It was edited by Holly Fisher. We're staying in Russia for a few more minutes. Playing you out, here's Vospominane by Nyusha. I'm Hugo MacDonald. Thank you for listening. Goodbye. Опять же, как-то мы с тобой друг друга.